Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Longtime magazine editor Elizabeth Egan thought she had landed the dream job, editing books at Amazon. She was 30-something. Her children were getting a little older. She was eager for a full-throttle career, ready to lean in. Moving to Amazon proved for her to be a full-throttle mistake. What she found was not so different from what the big expose in the New York Times found recently. She left Amazon and morphed the whole experience into a new novel, A Window Opens. This hour on Point, Elizabeth Egan and her story of leaning in Amazon style. You can join us on air or online with this conversation as always on. Have you tried to have it all? How's that going? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Cast your mind back just a couple of weeks. Here was a news report, ABC's Rebecca Jarvis, a day after that brutal New York Times expose on Amazon's workplace.
Tonight, the company that dreams of delivery by drone and uses robots to navigate that gigantic warehouse, now defending itself after a New York Times expose describes a nightmare workplace.
And it's not over. Now the ACLU coming after Amazon took out a full-page ad in the Seattle Times on Friday seeking Amazon employees who believe they were penalized for having children, for getting sick, or caring for sick relatives. Here was Q13 Fox in Seattle covering that story.
Today, the ACLU dropped this bomb, a full-page ad in the Seattle Times calling for a class action lawsuit against the company.
Oh, boy. Elizabeth Egan was there before it all hit the fan. She has written it all up novel style. Elizabeth worked as an editor in Amazon's publishing division for 13 months, starting in 2012. She's now books editor at Glamour magazine. Before her time at Amazon, she spent 7 years at Self magazine. She was also books editor there. Lifelong book lover. Her new novel is A Window Opens, a novel that's getting pretty great reviews, a protagonist for the lean-in generation, humor and heartbreak. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Elizabeth Egan joins us from New York. Elizabeth, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So you poor pummeled galley slave, how did you ever make it out of Amazon alive with enough energy and self-respect to write a novel?
Well, I feel lucky that I've landed where I've landed at Glamour, which is a very different work environment than the one I knew at Amazon. I think I was lucky in many ways. I only stayed at Amazon for 13 months after realizing fairly early on that it wasn't the right fit for me. And I was able to leave and to write this book, which is, of course, a novel, but there are parts of it that are drawn from the experience of feeling like a fish out of water or the old lady at the table. And that has been a dream come true, really, to finally, at age almost 42, write my first book.
The old lady at the table, you were in your 30s, I believe.
Yes, I was. But most of the people that I worked with were quite a bit younger. And in fact, most of the people that I work with at Glamour are quite a bit younger. And for the most part, I always, throughout my career, have found it to be a lot of fun to work with people who are in a different phase of life. But it also leads to misunderstanding sometimes. And occasionally, you know, you just feel that you're in a different phase of life. It's I was the only one in the office of Amazon where I worked, which was in New York. So it was a satellite office. I was the only one who was commuting from New Jersey. I was the only one with three small children. So I really was the only one at a certain phase of life.
And was it hell on wheels for you?
I don't know that I wouldn't describe it as hell on wheels. It was very exciting in the beginning because I really was happy to be spreading my wings and happy to be trying something new. And it felt good to be learning this whole new language. And I was excited about editing books because I had always been a reviewer of books. But I went into my career when I first graduated from college thinking that I would be editing full-length books. So that part of it was really fun. It was just, for me, the corporate culture was very hard to navigate. And also, I discovered that I'm not as flexible as I would like to be. Part of working at Amazon is being able to pivot, as they say. And in the end, the job that I was hired for turned out to be a little bit different from what it actually was. And for me, that was the hardest part. And even though I understood why the company was making a decision to go in a slightly different direction, which to the average listener might not sound that dramatic, it was really a shift away from one type of fiction to a more commercial type of fiction. For me, it just wasn't what I wanted to do.
We really want to hear about that migration from an older world of publishing to the Amazon world of publishing and editing there, what that felt like. But first, tell us about the novel that you have brought this experience into. I mean, this is not directly your experience, but clearly you're drawing heavily on this.
Yes, thank goodness. Thank goodness it's not my exact experience.
Yeah, but we see where the inspiration came from. It's called The Window Opens. The company at the heart of it is not Amazon. It doesn't even do exactly what Amazon does, but it's pretty kind of closely related. You call the company in the book Scroll. Introduce us to your protagonist, who she is, what kind of woman she is, and what she gets into.
Her name is Alice Pierce. She's 38 years old. She's a mother of three. When the book begins, her kids are 5, 8, and 11. And her husband, who is a lawyer, has just lost his job in a spectacular fashion. He finds out that he's not going to make partner at his New York City law firm, mm-hmm. and has a bit of a temper tantrum and throws his computer across the room. And so overnight, Alice goes from being
that would be the conference room at the law firm, not real popular.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, no. And I would like to say, just for the public record, this husband is not based on my husband
okay,
thankfully.
Yeah.
But Alice needs to up the ante on the work front. She needs to make more money. And so she looks for a new job. And the job that she finds is at Scroll, which is a company. It's a retail company that has a chain of shopping malls throughout the Midwest. And they'd like to add a new type of store to their mall. And they envision these stores as the Starbucks of bookstores. And Alice's job is to be a content manager and to pick the books that are sold in the bookstores.
It's sort of lounge where you would browse.
Yes.
They got first edition books up on the walls. You can buy them, and there's coffee and there's snacks and a lovely reading experience.
Yes, there are these cushy lounge chairs that you can sit in, and all locally sourced baked goods. It was fun to come up with the idea for that because I think it's something that should exist. It was my dream scenario.
Yeah.
But soon after Alice gets to Scroll, she realizes it is not what she thought. And instead of curating this list of literary titles that she loves, she's asked to make this pivot to evaluate video games, which is not something she's even remotely interested in.
For the kids of maybe the mothers or fathers who are reading there, they want to open a kind of a Chuck E. Cheese video arcade sort of next
exactly.
door where the kids can amuse themselves while the parents get lost in good literature.
Yes.
And she's put in charge of video games instead of Harper Lee.
Exactly, exactly. And she doesn't allow her kids to play video games. She's never played a video game herself. And so to be put in charge of this initiative strictly because she's a mom is something that really irks her. And at the same time, her home life is kind of falling apart. Her father, who has had throat cancer about 10 years earlier, experiences a recurrence. And it's clear that his health is going downhill fast. She's very close to him, and he's a big influence on her. So it's also a book about caring for a sick parent while caring for your small children.
Her husband's kind of falling apart. She finds him drunk on the floor. He's drunk on the floor in the basement. Everything depends on the nanny, the babysitter. Without that, nothing works.
Yes. It's the perfect storm.
It's the perfect storm, and it sounds just bizarrely like the cases that have been cited coming out of Amazon just lately, where they said Amazon won't give anybody any slack, even when their personal health is falling apart, their family's falling apart, their parents are falling apart. Was this a kind of a weird gift from the gods that all of this hit the fan just as your book was coming out?
The timing was odd and surprising. I am happy to say that when I was at Amazon, my home life was relatively stable, and my father in real life did die of throat cancer, but about 10 years before. Thank you. And but I did wonder while I was working there and feeling that every area of my life was taxed and that I was spread in a million different directions, I did start wondering what would happen if there was that camel, you know, that straw that broke the camel's back. Mm-hmm. What if one more thing had been introduced? And I should say that in my office here in New York, I was allowed to work from home for one day. I do feel confident that the people who I worked for would have been sympathetic had I had a huge crisis at home. But I think that, you know, we see in workplaces these days this culture of work all the time. You have your phone in your pocket, so you have your office with you at all times. There's really the line between home and work has really eroded. We're all connected on social media together. We're all, you know, so it made me start thinking about these issues that I was talking about with friends, about what time do you turn your phone off at night? If you get an email from your boss at 10 p.m., do you answer it? Very soon after I started working at Glamour, I got an email from the editor-in-chief at about 5:30 in the morning, and I'm an early bird, so I answered it immediately. And then I got a quick response from her saying, please don't feel you need to answer my messages at 5:30 in the morning. I'm an early bird. And it was so reassuring to me to know those parameters, that there wasn't that expectation. But at Amazon, I did feel that there was that expectation that I needed to be available and I needed to be on the hook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Elizabeth Egan, book editor who went off to work at Amazon, found it not to her taste, came out, wrote a pretty terrific book about it called The Window Opens, a novel about a 30-something mother, three kids, husband who's sort of in a career crisis, health problems in the family, the fictional character's father, trying to do it all, lean in, have it all, and really, really it not working in rather spectacular fashion for a while, at least. Of course, when she started this, who knew that Amazon's workplace and work ways would become a kind of national source of infamy after that big New York Times expose on just how rough it can be there. Amazon has pushed back. Their senior VP of corporate affairs is none other than a former White House press secretary, Jay Carney. Here he was on CNN defending Amazon after that report, calling Amazon an incredibly compelling place to work. Listen to this, and then we'll hear about Elizabeth Egan's fictional, maybe parallel company. She calls it Scroll. Here's Jay Carney.
Every qualified engineer and software developer, not just in the United States, but in the world, as well as lawyers and others who are interested in the tech field, have their pick of companies to work for. And they come to Amazon because it's a great place to work and because they find it challenging and they love the ethos that we're all focused on delivering for the customer. And they also like the fact that unlike a lot of workplaces, including places I've worked, it is absolutely standard and expected to question everybody's ideas.
It's great. It's great. Come on in. Elizabeth, we have callers for you. Laura in Salem, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Elizabeth Egan. Thank you for calling, Laura.
Ms. Egan, hi. Maybe I should call you Alice because I'm kind of focused on the book. If Alice has children 5, 8, and 11, clearly, I mean, to my eyes, there's a plan there. You plan to have three kids. There's nothing new under the sun. Margaret Mead, I think, put it best. She said, yes, women can have it all, but not at the same time. It doesn't make sense to throw yourself into a company that you know ahead of time is going to take maybe 20 out of your 24 hours and expect to be able to, you know, care for a sick parent, you know, nurse a drunk husband, you know, whatever else it takes. You can't have it at the same time. I have nieces who are twice as smart as I'll ever be, and they're born online. They've got their devices, but they can also read books and, you know, make reasonable decisions about, you know, their lives. But honest to Betsy, it's, you know, nothing new under the sun. Second, you know, second verse, same as the first.
I agree.
Yeah, what were you thinking, Elizabeth? Whatever were you thinking?
I was thinking what I think a lot of people in my generation who grew up with Free to Be, you and me, and who grew up being told you really can have it all. I'm not sure if I agree with Margaret Mead, as much as I, of course, completely respect her.
Well, you think you can have it all at the same time?
I guess I ask the question, would you tell a man he couldn't have it all? I think the question I ask in the book, in the end, Alice realizes the question is not whether or not you can have it all. The question I think we should be asking ourselves is, what do you really want? And I made the comparison that I think not thinking first about what you really want is a little bit like going to the grocery store with no shopping list. And in the end, you come home with a full cart of food, but you have nothing to cook for dinner, no meal to put together. And so I absolutely agree with, you know, Alice herself made this decision in sort of a hasty way, which in real life, I went into it a little bit more thoughtfully. But, you know, the crazy thing is that when I took my job at Amazon, I thought, well, my little one is about to start kindergarten. Life is about to get so much easier. I've been working part-time since my kids were born. And to me, it seemed I love what I do, and I was ready to spread my wings. And I felt, you know, I deserved to be able to spread my wings. But I didn't realize, and now I do, that kindergarten is not the end of parenthood. It's, you know, a whole new right. phase of things to start. So I think that's such a valid question. Why would you think that you could do it all?
I mean, but in fairness, I love Laura in Salem calling in here, but you've got other voices out there. Sheryl Sandberg saying, lean in, go get it, gals, you know, go for it.
And I think that I'm grateful to Sheryl Sandberg for saying that. And also there's another new book coming out on September 29th from Anne-Marie Slaughter called Unfinished Business, yeah. which covers similar ground. And I love this book, too. But I think it's also important to hear from normal women like me. I am not a powerhouse. I'm not running a company. I don't have a black town car waiting for me outside. I'm your regular workaday woman, and I feel that pull between my family and my work that I love and my own sense of ambition. And I think we all agree that family comes first. But one of the things that I didn't realize until I had kids is sometimes the choices are not that clear. There are days where you have a sick kid and you have something happening at work that you really want to be part of. To be here on NPR this morning, I'm missing my older daughter's freshman orientation in high school. My husband was happy to go, but my daughter was a little bit bent out of shape that I couldn't be there.
Now we feel guilty.
Don't feel guilty. For me, you know, I explained to her, this is a big moment for me. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
But the choices are not, you think you'll always go with family, but there are those times when you feel that pull of ambition and a pull of what's important to you. And so the choices are not as clear as you think they will be when you first start out.
Elizabeth Eakin's new book, it's a novel, is A Window Opens. Lots of people calling with experience of your experience. Jasa in New Orleans, Louisiana. Jasa, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for writing the book. I think there are so many of us working moms out there who are struggling with these issues. I'm a full-time attorney. I practice immigration law, so I'm super busy all the time. And I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and my kindergartner just started school. She had some issues. I ended up having to get her teacher changed. So there's like you said, kindergarten, you think it's going to be like, oh, great, it's so much easier. They'll be in school all day. But no, there's all these other issues that we never even imagined. And she even told me this morning, Mommy, if you get home early, maybe we can spend more time together. And it just breaks her heart. And she's 5, and she's begging for more time, and there's just not enough hours in the day. I don't get home until 6:30. You know, we had to move out of the city across the lake because the schools are better. So now I have a 45-minute commute each way, and I get home later. And I'm just constantly saying, okay, I have to work. I'm the main breadwinner in my home. I have to make sure to pay the bills. And then I have my children screaming for more time. And
what are you going to do about it, Jasa? Or do you just grin and bear it?
You have to grin and bear it. I'm trying to negotiate for more vacation time with my firm right now so that I can go to the field trips and take a day off to be room mommy for a day and things that I think are so important so my child knows that I'm there for her, but it's very hard because I was raised saying, you don't depend on a man. You need to make sure that you're fully independent. And then I find myself wishing, gosh, I wish I had been raised in the 40s or 50s so I could stay home and be with my kids and it would be perfectly acceptable.
Oh, legions of 70-year-old feminists are jumping out of the windows, Jason. But who can't sympathize? Elizabeth, speak. You're now an author,
absolutely.
So you're wise.
I feel I'm not. I'm not. The whole point of this book is I'm not wise, but I've been there and I have one bit of advice and one bit of reassurance. The advice is be very careful. You know, just be where your kids are concerned. Be careful how you spend your time. When my kids first started school, I was very active in the PTA for about a year and I got involved in the gift wrap fundraiser. Yeah. And then I quickly realized my kids don't appreciate. I felt like I was doing stuff for them, but I wasn't actually with them. So I try to do, when it comes to volunteer stuff, I try to do the things. I try to plan my schedule so that I'm actually doing things that they appreciate. Maybe I go to the class party every now and then. And by the way, I'm never the mom who brings the special Halloween cupcakes with the licorice spider legs. I'm the mom who brings the cutlery, if anything. The bit of reassurance I would like to offer is that it really gets so much easier as your kids get older. As we used to say,
when your childhood's over, is that what you're saying?
No, even my kids are 8, 11, and 14 now.
Yeah.
And I feel I remember the days when I was in the weeds, as we used to say, in our waitressing days. Now my kids stay up later. They can eat dinner later.
Time
they're
you
a
can
little
share
bit more
with
flexible.
Them. Yeah.
And they
yeah.
care about your day. When you come home, they yeah. say, "How was it?" And I'm proud of you. And, you know, of course, they don't always say that. They also have a lot of complaints about the weird bread you packed in their lunch. But, you know, it becomes a little bit more of a give and take. And you don't feel that hard deadline of if I don't get the 6:18 train, I won't be home by 7, then I won't be able to read stories. It does get so much easier.
But,
and the other final bit of advice I would say is make friends who have a good sense of humor who are in the same phase of life. For me, aside from my husband, those friends, men and women, were my saviors. It's not just a mom problem. It's a human problem. And I think the beauty of Sheryl Sandberg and Anne-Marie Slaughter and these great big thinkers is we're changing the conversation. So it's we've evolved so that it's not just our problem. It's everybody's conversation and everybody's commitment to finding a solution that works.
Maybe. I don't know. Reading the Amazon story, I'm not sure that I could 100% say mm-hmm. that's true. But you've got a fresh take on it. Of course, even in your take, there's plenty of suffering that goes on. People magazine says fresh, funny take on the age-old struggle to have it all. Maybe it's an old struggle, but it can be very, very acute these days. Elizabeth Egan captures it in A Window Opens. Elizabeth in Miami, Florida. Elizabeth, you're on the air with Elizabeth in New York.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi there. My experience is a little bit different from the ladies that I've been hearing from. I have been working in corporate America for the same company for nearly 30 years. So I have had my children while working for this company,
okay.
and now I'm almost an empty nester. And I disagree with what Elizabeth said about the fact that it gets easier. It doesn't. I mean, even my children that are living out of the home still have questions for me about health insurance and car insurance and all of those
yeah,
things.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, parenting never ends. That's dawned on me. And unfortunately, I think part of the problem is being a salaried worker, that the demands on your life are never ending. And you know, the answer is, if you get your work done, I don't care what time you come or go. But during the recession, the volume of work that was given to us was insurmountable.
Elizabeth, were there times in your working life when you felt like you just lost control of it and maybe lost your link to your family?
Oh, yes. How about I went to work at 7 in the morning and I left at 5 a.m. so that I could go on vacation? How about my daughter called and said, Mommy, the water is not on. I realized I failed to pay the water bill. They shut the water off.
Mm-hmm.
Has nothing to do with money. It has everything to do with time. You know, you lose
yes.
control of what's going on in the lives of your children, and I feel that I will be undoing that for years.
And sometimes it just gets away from anybody, from everybody. Let me get one more, if I may. Stand by there in New York, Elizabeth. Miami, thank you for calling, Elizabeth, there. Tracy in Nashville, you're on with Elizabeth Egan.
Hi, Tom. And thanks, Elizabeth. It's funny that this topic came on today because I'm actually in my car driving to my first account. And just before I left, I was discussing with my fiance. We both have we have two children, and they're 9 and 10, and they definitely keep us busy. And I agree with all the other listeners about how it just gets more challenging year after year. As they get older, they seem to get busier. But the discussion we were having was, you know, could I, you know, give up my job and be a stay-at-home mom? Because for years, you know, I am that type of mom that, you know, I want to have it all. I've been working in retail wine sales with a distributor for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And we're just coming into the busy time of year, and it starts to get a little more stressful every week with, you know, the emails and the dinners and the accounts. And, you know, also the anxiety starts to set in because the kids have just gotten back to school and they start to get busier, and the emails come from the teachers asking for volunteers and volunteers at the gymnastics studio.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm just starting to think, you know, that lean in feeling is the pressure of it. And like just this morning, I was up at 5 o'clock just to be able to go to the gym, come home, put laundry in, make cinnamon rolls for the kids before they get up, because not only am I that type of mom that wants to have it all, but I want it done perfectly. And, you know, the conversation with my fiance this morning was, is there a way to make it work where, you know, having it all means being a stay-at-home mom and being there for the kids, you know, cutting corners and going back to, you know, maybe that simpler time when, you know, women did stay at home.
So lean out a little bit.
About it.
In other words, lean out a little bit, Tracy.
Maybe. Yeah, lean out a little bit. And, you know, again, just today I was having that conversation and then this came on the air and I thought, you know, maybe it's okay to go back to, you know, cutting corners to make time for the kids and be home a little bit more and be more focused on them as opposed to being focused on just a job.
I'm so glad you called as well. Thank you, Tracy. Elizabeth, you know, we talked with Anne-Marie Slaughter when she first came out with her big article about these pressures. She had a very high-pressure job in the State Department, I think, when she was thinking about all that. Here's Tracy selling wine, and you've got Elizabeth in Miami who's got, I don't know, insurance business. There's so many venues in which it can just seem overwhelming. Add to that the sort of new age hyperdrive of leaning in and, you know, a startup, and you in the book anyway, it's just a recipe for, I can't take it at some point.
It is. And also there's the aspect of having not just the family that Alice lives with, but also her parents who she's very close to. And when her dad gets sick, she wants to be with him as often as she can. And people keep telling her that her kids will save her and that they'll carry her through, but all she really wants to be is with her dad. And because he has had throat cancer, he's had his vocal cords removed and he's not able to speak. And so for Alice, as it was for me in real life, that was a very powerful experience, loving someone who couldn't speak. And it made me realize I had to find my own voice in that situation.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a book editor's wild ride through a stint at Amazon and the novel that came out of it. A Window Opens by Elizabeth Egan. She joins us from New York about a fictional world of a company rather like Amazon in its culture, you might say, and a family, a woman that's sort of working head at this point, trying to work through it all. Elizabeth Egan joins us from New York, and now you are getting into the position of guru here, Elizabeth, and people are pitching in online. Home building says Amazon is what happens when capitalism is unbridled, along with social Darwinism. You write a book and soon you have to comment on social Darwinism. Let's hear a little bit just straight from the book, if you would be good enough. There's some orientation going on here. The big home office is in Cleveland. You say they refer to the home office as Big Daddy. Could you read a little bit from us to give us a sense of the culture of your fictionalized workplace?
Of course. Alice is very excited to be in Cleveland for this orientation because, of course, it means she gets to stay in a hotel room by herself, which is every mother's dream. Right. Main Street employees referred to the Cleveland office as Big Daddy. And Genevieve was right. Most of the women did wear blazers. The men wore hoodies, and 98% of them also had beards. Others had ponytails. Many had both. People at Main Street dove deep, jumped on a call, explored topics from a 30,000-foot perspective, and opened their kimonos to each other. When Main Streeters moved into a different space, they weren't referring to a new office. During orientation, we received instructions to leave an empty seat at the table in every meeting we would attend during our time at Main Street. "Why?" I whispered to the guy next to me, a metadata specialist who had just relocated from Dubuque. "For the customer," the guy whispered back, straight-faced, while frantically copying down the Venn diagram our instructor was sketching on the smart board. "Wait, what?" "The empty chair is for the customer, so he always has a presence in meetings." "Or her," I said, reflexively. "You mean like Elijah?" Even though every person in the room had endured the same grueling hiring process, our leader still conducted a thorough review of the tenets of winners, with the unfortunate pronunciation of tenants. I'd been classified as a level 6 employee. It turned out the highest level was 10, but there was no level 9, just to make the leap from 8 to the pinnacle seem all the more insurmountable. For help with procedural questions, best practice was to check the wiki page. If you still didn't have the answer you needed, you could file a trouble ticket. Trouble tickets lived in Gathering Place and were organized by 6-digit numbers. Your manager would be CC'd on any trouble ticket you filed, so new employees were cautioned to file them sparingly or risk flagging themselves as poor problem solvers. Winners answer their own questions, otherwise known as WATOQ, was the most sacred of all the tenants.
Winners answer their own questions. Elizabeth Egan, reading there from her new novel. Her first, A Window Opens, kind of fictionalized off of her time and experience at Amazon.com. Diane's calling from Franklin, Tennessee. Diane, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Elizabeth. I'm really looking forward to reading your novel.
Thanks,
Diane. I just retired after 30 years of federal law enforcement, and I raised a child, and I was constantly being called out in the middle of the night and going on, 30, 60-day TDYs. But that was the nature of my job. That was the field that I chose. And, I had a supportive spouse, and I just don't understand why corporate America feels like they need to email people at 2:30 in the morning. This isn't life or death book editing. I mean, I don't understand why men and women, and particularly men, really, don't just step up and say, this is unacceptable. We can't do this. We can't raise our families and be on call 24/7. And I think it takes both genders to stand up and say that to make it equitable for everyone. I think in my line of work, as I said, I was fortunate enough that I had a supportive spouse. I don't know how a single parent would do it. And it is very difficult for people in law enforcement or people who are first responders who have children who don't have spouses to help out. But so anyway, I think that's my point, is that it's corporate America's responsibility to ensure that their employees have a good quality of life, be they, whatever their gender is.
Diane, I just love your call, sort of what the law enforcement officer is saying. Come on, what is happening? Book publishing and you've got 2 a.m. calls for book editing? That's not life and death. What about it, Elizabeth?
Part of the problem, I should have clarified when I said that I heard from people at all hours when I worked at Amazon. Part of the issue was working in a satellite office. When I left my office at 6, it was only 3 o'clock in Seattle.
But we have read that the people in Seattle are the ones getting the 2 a.m. calls, not just the 5 a.m. or whatever.
I mean, I think it's a problem in all of corporate America. I mean, I think it happens in every company, and we all have this sense that if we can just knock off that email at 11, it'll save us time first thing in the morning, which it never does because it just opens up a whole other conversation that then continues into the night. I don't really know what the solution is. I know people who put their phone down at a certain time of night and don't pick it up again. But I find that hard to do. It's not my nature to have unread emails sitting there. I don't know what the solution is. I think there needs to be a conversation in your workplace about what the expectation is. Maybe it's what we have at Glamour, which is if somebody sends it, you are under no obligation to respond to it unless your page is shipping to the printer that night or whatever it is. But definitely that vibe that you need to be available on vacation or on weekends, that's just not that's not okay. When I was working at Amazon, really in my hardest moment, my husband pointed out that I was always available to my office when I was at home. But when I was in my office, I was often very hard to reach by people at home. And that really made me start thinking that if...
What's the priority here?
Exactly.
Well, speaking of the work, just talk with us a little bit about, I mean, you had worked with books, you were a book lover, you had done this at Self, and you do it now at Glamour, but the difference in texture and focus and sort of what was asked of you in the old book publishing world versus the new Amazon book publishing world, give us a sense of the different texture there.
Well, I had come from a background where my whole job rested on my gut instinct for what would be a great book and what books would do well. And those were the book, you know, I'm reading books as a book reviewer that are coming out months from now, and mm-hmm. I'm making a prediction about which ones we should cover in the magazine.
And you don't have a whole chorus of other voices around to affirm or point you.
Mm-hmm. No, I have marketing information mm-hmm. from the publisher, but, you know, I have a sense based on how a book is published, mm-hmm. whether or not, you know, how important it will be, for instance, or, but really what I go by is how much I love it. And for me, I mean, I realized soon after I got to Amazon that I was really more of a magazine person than an editor of books. So to begin with, there was a problem.
What kind of books were you editing at Amazon? We think of Amazon as a place primarily where these are books that are already produced and they're selling them.
Amazon publishes its own books. There's a huge mm-hmm. Romance division. There's a big thriller and sci-fi division.
So these were in-house productions in a way, or,
yes.
or their own.
Oh, input. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And I was hired to edit fiction, and I quickly realized that the focus in publishing at Amazon is very much on this, on the data and the science of it, and my area of expertise was really the art piece of it. And I think publishing is a little bit of both.
But what's the data? How's that come into play? You've got a manuscript. It's not out in the world yet. There isn't any data on it. So what's the data factor?
Well, every publisher looks at comparable titles. If you're an editor at Random House and you would like to acquire a book, my understanding is that you go to your editorial board and you present a list of comparable titles with
sort of
some
like
data.
This that have done well. Okay.
Yes.
So how did that
yes.
come into play at Amazon in your editing?
The focus felt very much on what other books like that book had come out. The focus was so heavily weighted in that area. The example that I always use is a book like Wild, which had already come out before
Cheryl Strayed.
I started. Mm-hmm. Yes. But so imagine you're a book editor. You're taking that book to your people and you're saying, I'd like to acquire this book by a woman who hiked 1,100 miles by herself. She did it 16 years ago. She kept careful notes, but it still was 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She's written one book before. Often they look, you know, at an author's
right.
track record. Mm-hmm. She's written one book before that did well, but I don't think it was a huge bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
But the editor's job is to be able to sense the electricity on the page of a manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it's just black and white words on
mm-hmm.
a page. It doesn't have a cover. It doesn't have deckled edge pages.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have, you know,
right,
it's just
right.
words on a page.
Mm-hmm.
And the editor's job is sensing where lightning is about to strike.
And you're saying they would have looked at Cheryl Strayed's Wild and said, forget it.
I, I think that it would have been a tough sell. I think that they it was a very tough process to acquire a book. And I came to really respect the way of thinking. It just wasn't my way of thinking.
And this is the Amazon very data-driven way in particular, you're saying, would have been tough on a book like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that there it's not enough to be a creative person or an editor. You really also have to think like a business manager and a business person. And I see the value in that, but I'm not that person. And I realized it early on. I mean, I left that job with so much. I learned how to use Excel, which was a first for me. I still don't like it, but I know how to use it. And I came into the magazine world with a new perspective on editing. I realized, you know, when I edit a story now, I approach it as if I'm the producer of the story. I handle it from all angles. How will we do it online? How will we cover it in the magazine? What will we do on our digital edition? You know, working at Amazon taught me to think big. That's one of their leadership principles. And I think there's some value in that, a lot of value in that. But for me, when it actually came down to dealing with the data, it all fell apart.
I mean, they think big. They are big. As someone who's edited and has been in publishing, how do you think that's going to shape the literature that comes to us over time?
I don't know. I think we've seen the way that it has affected the way we buy books. And I realized also that my local bookstore, which is a block from my house, is way too important to me to be buy. I don't buy a lot of books from Amazon. My kids, when they're reading a series with 37 different books, I might order those on a Kindle. But my community bookstore works as a community center, a temple, a church, a gathering place. And my kids have grown up there the way that Eloise grew up at the Plaza. It's a huge part of our life. And I want that to keep going. So I realized that for me personally, that was extremely important.
What about the whole lean-in message and how you've come away thinking about that? Sheryl Sandberg, of course, a chief operating officer at one of the biggest digital companies in the world. She wrote that. There's a lot of talk about it. And then it wasn't that long after that that tragically her own husband died, fell off a treadmill in Mexico and died way, way too young. I mean, that's her personal story. But what about the lean-in message that many women are hearing?
I love the message, but I think that we all need to acknowledge that if work is one umbrella and life is another umbrella, under the life umbrella, there are many, many spokes. It's not just your spouse and your children. It's your own parents. It's your friends. It's your health. It's your hobbies. We should be able to have hobbies. And I think I love the rallying cry. I love the idea behind it. But I think that we need to admit that there are complicating factors in life sometimes. And there are periods of your life where you may not have it all and you might not want it all. And that's okay, too.
For your generation, is that still distinctly somehow a woman's problem or issue, or are men sharing?
I think it is definitely not a woman's problem. It's, as I said before, a human problem. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to report that in my corner of the world, everyone is part of that conversation. I started dating my husband in college, and I remember very early in our relationship, far long before we were thinking about getting married or, of course, before we were thinking about having kids. I remember my husband saying that one of the proudest days of his childhood was when his mother graduated from college. I think he was about 11. And then he remembered her going off to work for her first job and wearing one of those big floppy bow tie things that were very popular in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I remember even as a 21-year-old thinking, this man comes from people who share the work, where both parents' work is valued, where the dad does the laundry and the cooking. And, you know, I was lucky enough to marry a man who just came from that tradition. But I think we all need to be careful. We need to pay attention to how we raise our kids. I feel like the next great movement in in parenthood is like teach your son to cook, teach your daughter to mow the lawn. You know, just to be mindful about how we speak to our kids to make so that when they are adults and they find themselves in this situation, they know this is not one set of problems for a man and one set for a woman. It's everybody's. Everybody should be participating in the conversation.
Hear, hear. And listen, meanwhile, here you are. You have leaned in. You're out with your first novel. It's getting a great reception. In your own way, you've done it. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't think you ever have that moment where you say, I've arrived.
I don't know about arrive, but you've leaned in.
It feels good. I'm very proud. I wrote most of this book on the train to work. So who knew that it would actually work?
It's a terrific read. A window opens. A novel. Elizabeth Egan is the author. Elizabeth, thank you so much and good luck. We'll look for the next.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced with a lot of help from a lot of great producers. Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica among them. With help from Aidan Conley, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.